All right. Don't have a picture show tonight, so it. But we continue to deal with Christ in the Old Testament. And so we've gone through a few places in Genesis. If you haven't been here, we started the last couple of weeks looking at Christ in Exodus. And basically going to deal with three things, as I think I announced on last week. We dealt with the Passover already, so then now we're going to deal with Christ being the manna, how that they're similar to each other, and then Christ as the mercy seat. And those are, something else in Exodus that comes to my mind that we'll look at, but those are the three that I plan to. And again, we've already covered the Passover, so now we're going to deal with Christ as the manna from heaven. And if you have your Bibles, turn to John chapter 6 just for a moment, and we'll take a look at the passages that reference this. Remember, I've said that there's different kind of types, and some types are just assumed, and others are things that are specifically stated in Scripture. And so Jesus being the manna or bread is something that he himself referred to. And that's why we can use it with so much confidence. But John chapter 6 at verse 31, it says, "Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Jesus then said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And they said to him, "Sir, give us this bread always." Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst." And then at verse 38, he refers to himself as the bread of life again, says a few more things about that down at verse 58. "This is the bread that came down from heaven, not like the bread the fathers ate and died. Whoever feeds on this bread will live forever." And you remember, it was this conversation that led to many of his disciples going back and walking no more with him. And so they got very upset when he spoke about himself as the bread of life. What we'll do is we'll look at this a little more next week. But let's begin by going over to Exodus chapter 16. And that's where we read about the manna as it was introduced. And so we'll just spend our time tonight here in Exodus 16. Next week we'll make the applications and the comparisons between Jesus and manna. And remember, everything that has happened in the book of Exodus, really, all the things, everything related to the people of God, has been by the mercy and the grace of God. This is a great time for them, really, because they have been liberated. They have been set free from the Egyptian bondage. And it was really all about the grace, the mercy of God. They have done nothing, really, when you stop and think about it. The idea that they broke the spirit of Pharaoh and the Egyptians were broken, that had nothing to do with them. God did that through the 10 awesome plagues that we have recently studied and set forth. Them being led, guided from Egypt. You remember they went first to Succoth and then finally to Ethan that was on the edge of the wilderness. And they didn't guide themselves. God did that by the pillar of fire at night and the pillar of ground of the cloud in the day. So that was all God. And of course, we then read in chapter 14 of the opening of the Red Sea. And we know, obviously, that was all God. And so this whole deliverance that they had from Egypt, and remember, Egypt is always a type of the world. But their deliverance from Egypt was by God. They were saved by grace, we might say. And the fact of the matter is they recognized that. And that's the interesting thing of how in tune they were with all of this being a demonstration of God's great power. If you look at chapter 14, the end of chapter 14, and at verse 30, it says, "Thus the Lord saved Israel." Obviously, they didn't save themselves. The Lord did that. The Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. But now watch their response at verse 31. It says, "Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so that the people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses." And so, they're just, at this particular stage, they have a lot of trust and confidence in God because they have seen his great power. In fact, in chapter 15, chapter 15 is just a chapter of praise and worship. And in fact, they even break out in dance with tambourines. But it's all based upon their acknowledgement of the greatness of God. Let's read just a little bit of chapter 15. We'll not stay there very long, but I just want you to see the attitude of Israel, which they don't really sustain very long. But at this point, you just notice the language. They write and sing this song of Moses. Verse 1 says, "Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, 'I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song.'" And think about that. We know who these people end up being, but the attitude that they have. But right now they're singing this powerful song. "The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will exalt him." That's a good attitude, isn't it? That's the attitude we should all have. God is my strength. The Lord is my strength. He's my salvation. That is stated over and over. You remember David, of course, he had the good attitude that his trust was completely in God. Look at Psalms 62 and beginning at verse 1. Psalms 62 at verse 1. This is a familiar psalm, a psalm of David. It says at verse 1, "For God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken." And you see that kind of language in the Psalms over and over. It's interesting in Psalm 66, you have the same kind of wording. But in this psalm, it's connected back to the Exodus. It says at verse 1, "Shout for joy to God, all the earth. Sing the glory of his name. Give to him glorious praise. Say to God, how awesome are your deeds. So great is your power that your enemies come cringing to you. All the earth worships you and sings praise to you. They sing praises to your name. Come and see what God has done. He is awesome in his deeds toward the children of man. He turned the sea into dry land. They passed through the river on foot. There did we rejoice in him." And we see that rejoicing over here in Exodus chapter 15, don't we? That's what's going on here. And when you read the psalm, and you know, one of those was a psalm of David. The other one's not titled so far as who wrote it. But we expect that in Psalms. This is kind of unusual to hear coming from the children of Israel, but this is the confidence that they have in God because they have seen with their own eyes the great power of God. They saw the awesome plagues that broke the spirit of Pharaoh and the Egyptians. They see the opening of the Red Sea. Can you imagine being there and seeing that and actually walking through the Red Sea as on dry ground? You know, we're not surprised that they had this kind of attitude. What surprises us is how quickly it disappears. Like, just like that. When we get to chapter 16, we find now all of a sudden their praise turns to panic. Their worship turns to worry. And it's like they completely forget everything that they were praising God for just in the previous chapter. It reminds us, there's a good lesson for us, how quickly our faith can dissipate. I mean, just it seems like with the people of God all through the years, just a few things can happen, or sometimes nothing happens at all. Like what happened with the Israelites from chapter 15 to 16, that no devastating event takes place or anything like that. But again, through the years, the people of God, you remember in Galatians, we're so familiar with this, but just the wording of Paul in Galatians chapter 1, when those saints were on the verge of leaving the faith, you recall. In this case, because of the Judaizing teachers that plagued them throughout the New Testament. But I like the ESV in Galatians chapter 1 at verse 6. It says, Paul says, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Paul said, I'm astonished by this. How quickly, like, just like that, it seems. Paul said, I was just with you, teaching you, and I'm just astonished that you so quickly now are deserting Christ, turning to a different gospel. And that, again, the people of God, through the years, I've been surprised at times. Brethren who seem to be strong, and the next thing you know, they're leaving the faith. And it's really shocking. It's surprising, but it's a lesson to all of us that any of us can do exactly what the Israelites did or what some brethren have done through the years. If we're not careful and we don't make up in our mind, we're going to be steadfast. We're going to be grounded and rooted. We're not going to let the devil move us away from God. We'll be unmovable. We'll be steadfast. If we don't make up in our mind to do that, it could happen to any of us. Any of us can fall. And it could happen very quickly. And we've seen that time after time. I remember Peter, look at 2 Peter chapter 1. Peter realized that. You ever wonder why it is that preachers will be so repetitive? The preacher always preaching the same thing. You got to hear that sermon on this again. I've heard that 100. Why? Precisely because the people of God need fundamental basic teaching over and over again to keep them from quickly deserting. And Peter recognizes this. In 2 Peter chapter 1, watch what he says down at verse 12. He says, therefore, 2 Peter 1 verse 12 says, therefore, I intend always to remind you of these qualities. He just had spoken of, remember, wrote of qualities that can keep us from falling. And so he says, I intend always to remind you of these qualities, though you know them. I'm not trying to teach you anything new. It's my intention to hammer these qualities in you over and over again. Even though he says you know them and are established in the truth that you have, I think it right, as long as I am in the body, to stir you up by way of reminder. Why? Because any of us could leave the faith, and it's surprising sometimes how quickly it could happen. And it's just amazing. And this, go back to Exodus now, and this is what happened with the Israelites. One day they're singing praises to God, and they're singing about God being their strength and their salvation and all of that. And then we get to chapter 16. In chapter 16, it says, and they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they had departed from the land of Egypt. So it's only been about a month or so since the Passover was instituted. And so they're now on the road, and they're traveling, and it says the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And so just like that. And what are they grumbling about? What in the world? Again, as I said a few moments ago, nothing devastating has really happened. Now, they have left Elam. Elam, if you remember from previous studies, was an oasis there. And so there were water wells, I think 12 water wells and 70 palm trees. It was a paradise in the midst of all that territory there. And maybe it was moving on to from that, that their supplies have to be getting low. Like, remember, there's probably at least 2 million people or so. You know how? It'd be kind of hard to keep up with supplies with that many people. And so maybe they're just getting nervous about that. But basically, they end up grumbling and demonstrating really a lack of faith, all caused because they're hungry. That really is the cause. Verse 3 says, and the people of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole congregation with hunger. And so they're hungry. And you would think, you know, wouldn't these people think, again, they have just seen the power of God. They have just seen God open the Red Sea. They're mindful of all of those plagues, particularly the final plague, that all the firstborn were killed. But all of the plagues were awesome and demonstrations of God's power. You would think they would look at that and say, you know, I think God could probably come up with a meal for us here. You would think. But it's like they have forgotten the power of God that they were praising just in the previous chapter. Now, someone made the point, that a principle that we should remember about us, about members of the church, but just about human beings really in general, is that too often we forget what we should remember, and we remember what we should forget. And that itself has plagued the people of God over the years. We remember things we should forget. Well, this happened to me. Well, that happened. And we hold grudges, and we have things just this cause bitterness in our hearts. With things we ought to just let go, we just remember and hang on to it for years and years and years sometimes. But then things that we should remember, namely blessings from God and how God has helped us and made provision for us through the years, somehow or another, and just a little bit of need, when we have a little bit of need, we seem to forget that. Like it never happened. Like God hasn't provided for us providentially over and over again. In a time of need, a lot of times people of God just, it's like they forget. And that's what has happened with the Israelites. We have to learn from that. We need to count our many blessings. And you know what happens a lot of times is we forget, we have that misremembery of things that God has done for us because we romanticize the past. We think in our minds of how things, the good old days, how things used to be, and it's usually always exaggerated. That's exactly what the devil wants us to do. Remember, the devil's goal is to get you back to the world. And how can he get you back to the world? He knows that if he can get you thinking about the past, looking in the past and thinking about it with an exaggerated view of how good things were, he knows that that might draw you back to the world. And that has happened many times. Because we look back and think, oh man, I remember it was so great when it really wasn't that great. Someone has called it selective memory disorder. And we sometimes, I don't know how the mind works, but sometimes that happens. And that is, just read this again here in Exodus at verse 2. The people of Israel said to them, Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. If you read the account in Numbers chapter 11, they even get more specific. They mention more things like cucumbers and links and onions and garlic and again bread to the full and just looking back as if, boy, it was great in Egypt. Let me tell you what they didn't have in Egypt. Bread to the full. They may have had bread. They may have had all those things that are mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, but they didn't have them in great abundance. They were slaves. And not only were they slaves, we know from the Exodus account, they were mistreated slaves to the point where they cried out to God in anguish. But now they're thinking back. And wasn't it wonderful? And they're thinking that because in their present state, they can't figure out where they're going to get food. Listen, they're hungry, but they're not starving in the wilderness. Like, they had some provisions. I don't know if their provisions had completely run out or were just running low and they were worried about it, but they weren't starving. A month ago, they were partaking of the Passover. And so, I mean, not a whole lot of time has passed, but this is how the devil operates. They're thinking about how great it was in Egypt, and now they're yearning to go back. And throughout the history of the children of Israel, that plagues them. How many times do you see in various passages, long after this, the Israelites saying, let's go back to Egypt. Let's get a leader, lead us back to Egypt. Like, really? You don't remember? That wasn't so great back then. You were mistreated servants back then. Why in the world do you want to go back there? And because that's what discontentment causes. It causes you to look back in the past and you exaggerate things about it. We have to be careful about that. How many people have left the faith, gone back to the world because they think about the good old days and how good it was? When you stop and, you know, you just kind of purposely forgetting the problems that fulfilling the lust of the flesh and doing your own thing and not following God, you forget about that and how much better you have it now that you are following Christ. And we forget to count the blessings and really think about the times when God has blessed us and how wonderful it is to be where we are right now. Don't let a few bad things that happen to you in your life say, oh, I wish I was back there. Because it's nothing good back there. But so here they are. They're complaining. They want to go back. And what does God do? Here's another great lesson. How does God respond to them? By the way, if you find yourself being a complainer, grumbling all the time, you need to reassess your spirituality. Because there's nothing good about that at all. And generally, when you're completely, in this case, who are they complaining against? Right. But it doesn't say that, does it? Later on it does. But here in the beginning, what does it say in verse 2? They're grumbling against who? Moses and Aaron. But Joe's right. What they were really doing is grumbling against God, even if they didn't realize it. Because Moses and Aaron were just the ones God chose to lead them, but they weren't really the leader. It was really God who was leading. They were where they were because that was the will of God. And complaining and grumbling against Moses and Aaron, Moses points out, who are we? It's really God that you have a problem with. If you find yourself always complaining in the church and you're murmuring about the preacher maybe or the elders or whatever, Who are you really have a problem with? Who are you really grumbling against? It may be God. It may be God. And that's always a dangerous thing to do. But God is a God of grace. He's a God. God knows us. And he knew his people back then. And so here they are. They're grumbling. And it seems as if their faith has been lost. They're worried now. And so what happened to that God is great and he's our strength and all of this? Seemed like they're not even thinking about that now. But what does God do? Verse 4 says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not.'" And so manna is introduced here. And it's the Israelites who call it manna. And there are different reasons why that is set forth, different commentaries and scholars, why they would call it manna. It's not all that important. It has to do with the wording of it, what it means. But God does call it manna a few times, but usually he refers to it as bread from heaven. And we're not surprised by that, because it is a foreshadow of who? Of Christ. And so, but what a wonderful thing. You think about God. Here are the people complaining and murmuring, and God blesses them. He doesn't give them what they deserve. You sometimes think, God didn't give me what I deserve. Don't ever say to God, "Give me what I deserve." Because what do you deserve? That's exactly right. Death. Ultimately, hell. But God doesn't give. That's what the grace of God is all about. It's why the Bible emphasizes, and we don't probably emphasize it enough, places like Ephesians 2, that we're saved by grace and not by works. Now, what kind of work? When Paul says that, what kind of works is he talking about? Meritorious works. And it doesn't mean that there isn't anything for us to do. That's for sure. And we do need to point that out, of course. But sometimes we just need to focus on the fact, the first part of that. We are saved by grace. We're saved in spite of ourselves, of our weaknesses, our sinfulness. We have all sinned, and we all sin from time to time. It's by the grace of God that we're saved. As Paul said in Ephesians, it is a gift. And we need to view it like that. Like, we serve a wonderful, merciful God. We're not, we come down hard on the children of Israel, and we should learn from their mistakes and their lack of faith at times, but we're not so unlike them. There are plenty of members in the body of Christ who are just like them. And in some ways, at some points in our life, we all act like them. And God continues to be merciful to us. That's the kind of God we serve. And we should always remember that. They're complaining. They're demonstrating a lack of faith. And he says to Moses, "Well, then, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to rain bread from heaven for you. And the people should go out and gather a day's portion every day." Now he's blessing them, but he's also testing them. And he does this in a couple of different ways as we read through this. It says that he's going to rain bread from heaven for them, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us?" Isn't that interesting there where it says that, and Moses said to them, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Didn't they just sing a song about that? Praising God. They have to be reminded, don't they? How many times do we have to be reminded how great God is and all that he has done for us? But it's just interesting how thoroughly they have forgotten that. Verse 8, and Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because of the Lord has heard your grumbling that you grumbled against him, What are we that you have that you're grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord, as we talked about earlier. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And as soon as Aaron spoke the word, the congregation of the people of Israel, they looked towards the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quail came and covered the camp. In the morning, dew laid around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. And when the people saw it, they said one to another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. Now, it's in the instructions that he gives. Most of us are familiar with this and God giving them, but it's in the instruction that he gives where he is really testing them. And again, testing them in two ways. First, he says, it says the people did so, and they gathered some more and some less, and had nothing left over. And whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. But it says they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Now, why do you think God didn't want them to have any left over? What do you think? This is a test for them. What do you think he's testing? Huh? Yeah, he is, and he's going to do that even more so in his next instruction. But there it is. Trust. Trust. Like, you can't have any left over. You have to trust that tomorrow I'm going to provide for you again. And the day after that, I'm going to provide for you today, at that day as well. And this would go on for 40 years. For 40 years, they had to trust and believe that God would take care of them and provide their provisions daily. He's testing their faith. And, of course, they failed. Some of them didn't do what he said. And what happened? They get up the next morning and what? It stinks around here in this camp. Moses smells it, and he was angry. You didn't do what I told you to, did you? But he's testing. Not unlike today. God, it's the simple principle that we need to learn, that we have to depend upon God. That's what God wants. All of his power, all of his strength, he wants you and me to trust him, to depend on him for our daily needs. Even in the prayer, you remember the prayer in Matthew chapter 6 as that prayer. Some people, of course, call it the Lord's Prayer, which is not. But you remember what he prayed for? Right. Daily bread. Pray. This is how you ought to pray, Jesus said. And one of the things he talked about is daily bread. Rely on God to provide for you. That's what he wanted. Number two, very quickly, we see with this matter, not only did he want them to eat it all, that was most of the time, but what did he want them to do on the sixth day? Right. He wanted to get double. So they wouldn't have to go out and work on the seventh day. And now that really was a test of obedience. Will you do what I tell you to do? Just follow my instructions. Did they? Some of them. Some of them did and some didn't. Some of them failed that test. And we're reminded of Deuteronomy chapter 8. Because that's where, you remember, Jesus quoted it in Matthew chapter 4 when he was being tempted. He quoted it to the devil. What can we not live by? By bread alone. But by what? Every word. That's right. That proceeds the mouth of God. And that's what this is about. That's all he's doing. All right. This manna, and when we look at this manna, it had the remarkable ability to sustain them. It's one of the things we'll draw a connection between that and Christ. This little flake-like substance, real thin. Josephus says that they thought it had snowed when they got up and saw. Because, I mean, just that's what it looked like. Little thin, white things. And by the way, in one place, it's described as, in one translation, of being cake that was with oil. It just says cake with oil. And when you think of something like that, you know, bread cooked in or with oil, what do you think of? What do we make in oil? Krispy Kreme, don't we? And so, I mean, you know, it was sweet like honey, it says, but it had a remarkable sustaining power. Gave them all the nutrients, everything they needed, whatever carbohydrates, whatever they needed to be sustained, it was able to do that. It's really quite remarkable. Had sustaining power. You can already be thinking, how is the manna like Christ? Does Christ have life-sustaining power? Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And so we'll take a look at more of that, exactly what the manna was. But it was really remarkable. But that wasn't going to sustain them alone. Don't live by bread alone. They had to follow the instructions of God. That's where a lot of people fall short. So we'll look at that next week.